Hey, thanks to the organizers and the lodge for this opportunity, and thanks for attending as we're getting close to lunch hour. So there's maybe a little bit of similarity with Lodge's talk. So I'm going to give you the historical perspective of the modeling we've been working on at Colorado State and ARS. And I've been at this for a while, almost two decades. My co-author, Bill Parton's been at it for almost four or so decades. And to tell you the truth, I could have listed, if I listed everybody as a co-author that's made significant contributions to the modeling and the experimentalists that have shared data with us and other modeling groups that have shared algorithms, all those names would have taken up all the slides. So this is the photo we have in our lab at the Ecology Lab at CSU. And I like it. It kind of summarizes a lot of what we're trying to model. The weather, the plants, the soil processes, and the grazers, for example. So one of the first models that was developed, I think it was the first at Colorado State, was the L model. And these were the objectives, mainly improve our understanding and how do ecosystems respond to management change, for example, to come up with optimal grazing strategies. So very, very good, honorable objectives. But the developers were the biologists, and they didn't really have a lot of experience in modeling. There wasn't really any modeling journals. This was back in the 70s. The computers were very slow compared to today. And you did have modelers in physics and math, but the biologists were basically trying to learn on the job. And so they wanted to include everything in that system, everything in that photo. So the plant production and phenology have competing plant species. They tried to use daily water and temperature model. They had insect consumers and mammal consumption. And, of course, subroutines for the soil processes and a weather generator. And this is just a flow diagram. This is maybe one-fourth of the L model. But if you just look at that insect consumer submodel, they got about seven life cycle phases of the insects. And so the problem was it was too complicated. This model never really got off the ground. They tried, they overdid it. And so it was a learning experience. It was successful in the sense of being a learning experience, but in any practical sense or usefulness, it was pretty much a complete failure. So then in the 80s, they stepped back a little bit and got more basic, didn't worry about doing all the predators, all the insects. You would still want to simulate the cattle grazers, for example. And they concentrated, really scaled it down and made the heart of the model be the carbon and nitrogen cycling. And hence, that's really the heart of the century model. And that was the first one out of this group that really did have practical applications because it could be used. It ran on a monthly time step for weather, for example. You can get monthly weather. And you could in those days as well. So in the 80s, century got used more. It was mainly at the site level because you didn't really have the regional model drivers you would need to run the model across the U.S. or across the globe even. But then in the 90s, then things really took off. We got some pretty good funding from different groups, NSF and NASA. Improved the carbon dynamics and plant growth. And then you started getting some of these global data sets, granted fairly large resolution, half a degree scale or so. So you still had limited spatial data, but at least you had some coarse data that you could. This is the first efforts to run the models around the world. And then starting in the 2000s, with interest in climate change, so the original century model didn't do nitrous oxide, just did plant growth and soil carbon changes. But with interest in greenhouse gas emissions and climate change, the nitrous oxide model had to be developed. So methane, nitrous oxide, all that was put into century in the early 2000s, and then we named it DAYCENT for daily century. And of course, if you want to do the nitrous oxide, you can't get away with a monthly weather time step. You really do need daily weather to drive that submodel, because as you know, You get a rainfall pulse. You can get most of your nitrous oxide emissions in 1 or 2 days. So just using, say, average monthly soil water content, you wouldn't have much success of trying to get the trace gas fluxes correctly. And then we started using the model for the EPA greenhouse gas inventory. And then recently, Comet Farm. It's really an interface meant for land managers, so it's a pretty easy to use interface. Once you get half decent at it, you can enter in your site level data for your farm in about half hour, 45 minutes, and then what it does is run Descent in the background and then spits out an answer, so you could do some what if scenarios, as was mentioned before. What happens if I change my management to my crop yields and net greenhouse gas fluxes, for example. And we have done some model comparisons, say trace gas emissions, DNDC versus Descent, but the comparisons aren't very well organized. I think the crop modelers have done a much better job. I think the AgMIP project might have been mentioned. They've done a real good job of comparing crop models. We got some catching up to do for our ecosystem models and trace gas flux models to really do good model comparisons. And I think that's a path forward. All these models, none of them, they all have strengths and weaknesses. We can learn from each other. And we've done that to some extent. We just need to do a better job. So this is our current Descent model. I'm not going to go in detail because it's simulating a lot of the same process as WEE's model. I think the DLEM model might be more mechanistic and more complex, but Descent is pretty much doing all the same processes, plant growth, soil carbon, nitrogen cycling, nitrification, denitrification, methane uptake. And we recently added methane emissions for the rice systems. So this is it's a pretty complete ecosystem model. And it's relatively easy to run because you just need daily weather, land management, vegetation cover, and know something about your soil, at least soil texture. So then some current and recent applications. So this is some of the biggest ones, the greenhouse gas inventory on the left. That's the cover from the EPA greenhouse gas inventory that gets compiled every year and turned into the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And then on the right is the USDA greenhouse gas inventory. That's the most recent edition that recently came out. And so since we signed that UNFCCC treaty, we have to turn in our emissions every year by economic sector, and our group is responsible for the agricultural sector, so we're running Descent across the U.S. at the NRI level. If you're not familiar with NRI, Natural Resources Inventory, there's about 400,000 agricultural points across the U.S., so we're simulating at very small spatial resolution. And then we do Monte Carlo runs. We do 100 Monte Carlo runs because we know what the land uses, but we don't know, say, for example, exactly how much fertilizer a particular farmer is adding. So we do PDF draws for fertilizer additions. So we're doing about 400,000 points times 100 Monte Carlo runs. So you can imagine this is such a big effort. There's probably a dozen of us involved between the scientists and the programmers and the database folks. And the reason we do the USDA inventory, it partitions things further, so it's consistent with the EPA inventory. But the EPA and the UN, they're mainly interested in the national level emissions, but in the USDA inventory, we partition things at a finer spatial scale, so we report the emissions at the MLRA level, and MLRAs are smaller than states. There's a couple hundred of them in the country, and we also partition emissions by cropping system, versus everything's just kind of lumped together in the EPA inventory. And you can download the USDA inventory, all the data that went into the figures and the maps and the tables, all those model outputs, they're all available for folks to download and evaluate or use for life cycle analysis or whatever. Another application is regional analysis of greenhouse gas emissions and crop yields through history. For this example, we did the Great Plains going back to the 1880s, and we accounted for the animal emissions, the soil emissions, the tractor use, so we kind of did a sort of life cycle greenhouse gas emissions through time of the Great Plains, and that was in a PNAS paper last year. And another is embedding Descent for soil greenhouse gas emissions and feedstock yields into bioenergy cropping system analyses. So you can combine the descent results with estimates of, say, how much fossil fuel you're displacing, what your upstream emissions are, et cetera, to get a complete greenhouse gas balance so you can fairly compare different systems with fossil fuel energy. Okay, thanks. So just some of the reasons why we think we've been successful. Yeah, you got to have some money. You got to be willing to follow the money trail with the grant proposals. We've always shared our code and executables. Like, you know, I can't overemphasize the level of collaboration that was necessary. So the ARS and other researchers supplying the data that you need to build and test your models. You know, working with other modeling groups, sharing code for submodels. I think that's really been the probably the most important aspects that lead to what success we have had. And then I just found this statistic. So these are the top cited papers in Soil Science Society of America Journal. And it looks like the original paper that described the century model by Bill and others is the number three most cited paper in the history of SSSJ. So it just gives you some idea of the impact that Bill has had in this modeling group and everybody that's contributed. So thank you.